thank you, Bill, for that kind welcome. I will pass on the opportunity to make any football analogies and confine myself to the brief in front of me. But I will make the comment on the Legislative Council. For those who aren't familiar with the Victorian legislative regime, the government has a very substantive majority in the Legislative Assembly, and unfortunately we are in deficit in the Legislative Council. Treasurer should not be talking about deficits. I'd like to say it isn't a deficit, but it is, and it does give just a little bit of grief from time to time. But opening up today, I'd like to acknowledge I'm John Harris, the State Director of CEDA Victoria and Tasmania, and thanks CEDA for the invitation, and also to welcome everybody to the lunch, and I will, as I said, be talking on the state of the Victorian economy. It's worth noting that 2 weeks ago today, I handed down in Parliament the annual financial report of Victoria, which outlined where we were at the end of the financial year, and a number of issues that came out of that. So I'll refer essentially to that as I go through my presentation. But it's worth noting that as I speak here today, a lot of things are happening. We got the new CPI figures out today, which for those who haven't seen them yet, and I'm sure probably that's probably about one person in this room, we had the headline inflation of 1.9, which is down, and the underlying inflation of 3, which is up. So there'll be a lot of discussion about that and a lot of focus on it, as there will be, because we are in the middle of a federal election where there was a very strongly contested view and opinion about where the future of the national economy will go and our society will go nationally. I guess what we have, and it's also worth acknowledging today, is actually United Nations Day as well, which is a very good segue into a lot of the issues that we face in the Victorian and the Australian economy are very much ones that are international. And I guess it's how we fit into that international and national picture that is one of the challenges we have as a state. Some of those national issues that we face are things, and they are fairly universal, whether they be things like climate change, water scarcity, response to terrorism, growing demands for energy, managing population growth. These are all issues that are a theme, whatever government you're in, whatever part of the world you're in, and they are absolute themes of the 21st century. But going on to our annual financial statement and where we are, the starting point is the Victorian economy is strong. As you will see from the chart on the screen, we have a couple of things about what we're seeking to do in this chart. There are two Australian economies. There is a resource economy and there is a non-resource economy. And what you see on that chart is that in Victoria, we're measuring ourselves against the non-resource economies. And for those who haven't looked recently at the GSP figures for Western Australia, they have growth in double digits. And that is growth off a resource boom. It is almost growth that you don't normally see in a first world economy. So we're looking at where we stand in the Federation. And what we see is we have a strong economy and we see we have growth levels, economic growth levels that are stronger than the comparable states in the Federation. We see that GSP growth is around 2.75% for the year just reported on, but we also know that some commentators, like Access Economics, are forecasting growth for next year in Victoria in excess of 4%. We know our employment is strong, business investment is strong. We've been averaging more than 10% per annum growth in business investment for the last 6 years. We also know that non-dwelling construction is up 11.5% in the last quarter. It was the highest in any state. We've also seen higher than forecast surpluses, lower levels of debt. In fact, our net financial liabilities in Victoria, as I speak today, are the lowest in the past 50 years. So in the annual financial report, we saw a windfall bigger than we thought, and we've now invested that back in capital. And that's the underpinning of this state government. We will invest in capital and in infrastructure. So from this year's surplus, which was larger than we expected, we have invested $600 million in water infrastructure, in a food bowl in northern Victoria, and a further $300 million in bringing forward the purchase of rolling stock on our public transport system. So what we think is important is you invest, if you have a windfall, you invest it in future capital, which you have to invest in any case. The next slide we have is we're talking of strong employment growth. And yes, we are the second largest state in the country, but it comes as a surprise to many that the actual employment growth this year is stronger in Victoria than in either of the big resource states, and Queensland's population is not that far behind us, and is certainly stronger than in New South Wales. So we're seeing strong employment growth, and we've achieved these results because of the tremendous record of jobs growth in Victoria. And we've achieved that despite a skills flight to the resource states in some areas, despite an appreciating dollar, despite the drought. We've achieved it because of a diversified economy that is focused on growth. And we've also achieved it because we in Victoria have sought and achieved the largest percentage now of skilled business migration. We've focused on these as important areas to us. Again, the graph in front of us shows strong population growth. If we look at the graph, we see quite clearly where Victoria is, where Australia is, and remembering that we aren't the warm climate of Queensland, we don't have the resource boom, but we have strong population growth. Moving on, comparing it, and I'm not trying to be too competitive here, but if hypothetically you were to compare us to another large city on the eastern border of Australia, what we're seeing here is that Melbourne's population growth is much stronger than Sydney's, and there's a whole range of reasons for that, and we think it is a responsibility of a state government to maximise your advantages. For us, there are some key issues there. There is livability in this city and this state is very strong. Livability is a great strength of us. And government's roles in targeted infrastructure investment, in planning systems, and making it a competitive economic environment all play a part in population growth. But this is just not in Melbourne. This is across the whole of Victoria where our population growth is strong. And we've also seen it comes with a robust and healthy housing and constructing sector, and we've been outperforming all other states in terms of building approvals. Again, the graph just there of New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland, our building approvals in the last financial year in actual dollar terms were larger than any of the other states. That's just a part of strong economic performance. So what we're seeing here is business expenditure on R&D in, again, comparing a series of Australian states. And again, what we're finding is there is big investment in R&D, higher in this state than anywhere else, which plays an important role in growing the economy. But don't just take it from me, the Victorian Treasurer saying that. The Financial Review earlier this week made this headline, which actually did make me smile when I saw it, made me feel proud to be a Victorian. But again, it just highlights that Victoria is a good place to do business. If people are prepared to invest in this state, and people are, it makes an extraordinary difference for us. And the challenge for us as a state government is to put the settings in place that encourage that business investment, which is such a big part of a strong economic performance. But moving on, there are some future risks and challenges for us. And we certainly need to be very aware of those. Some of them are fairly obvious. There is strong growth in emerging economies. And by that I'm not referring to Western Australia and Queensland. They are some issues. I'm talking of China, I'm talking of India, I'm talking of the Philippines, I'm talking of Thailand, where there is strong growth in emerging economies around us. And that offers challenges for us in a global economy, and particularly with some of our traditional manufacturing. It also offers opportunities for us. There's a slowdown in the US economy. And while we may not be anywhere near as exposed we once were to the US economy, the impact of the subprimes but a few months ago in the US clearly flowed through to stock markets across the world. And so the US is certainly a slowdown in that economy is something that we in a world economy need to be conscious of, and that is one of our short-term risks. There's inflation. I mentioned the figure earlier on and what the actual headline rate was today and what the underlying rate were. I guess you can read that either way. You know, is it an issue or not an issue? But clearly inflation, oil prices, wage pressures in state governments are always issues of short-term risks for us that we need to manage. interest rates and housing affordability. Interest rates, well, that will play out what the Reserve Bank does in the next few days, and I'm sure there's a lot of speculation on what it may or may not mean. But housing affordability is an issue for us which we need to focus on. The main levers in housing affordability clearly are national government issues on interest rates. And while the Victorian economy plays a role in that, it is overwhelmingly national. But on the other aspects of housing affordability, land supply, land availability is something very much which this state government has made a clear pipeline of land availability through Melbourne 2030 and the urban growth boundaries and a range of other policies. And on the supply side and on the demand side, we've also addressed it with a targeting towards first home buyers. But they are a short-term risk for us. It is worth noting on housing affordability that we in Victoria at the last census had 69% of our population actually owning or paying off their own home. It was 2% lower than it was 5 years ago, but we are higher than the national average, and for the vast majority of Victorians, home ownership is a reality. But yet the policies on housing affordability, whether they be the federal ones on interest rates or land supply demand, are ones we obviously need to keep and will remain focused on. And the final one of the short-term challenges is agricultural conditions. As I speak, the Premier is in Warwick, Nabil, announcing a $100 million drought package for Victoria, and it just seems to be that this seems to be cyclical whenever we're in these circumstances we are. It is a very difficult time in a lot of our for a lot of our primary producers, and it's one of the areas that is certainly something that we are aware of is a challenge for us. Moving on to longer-term challenges, they're fairly, again, as I said earlier on, some of them are worldwide, some are more local. One of our challenges in Victoria is managing population growth. We have very strong population growth, the national average or higher, and again, considering the impact of we don't have the warmer climates and particularly the resource economies, we are holding our own and more. Melbourne 2030 is clearly a plan to deal with the growth of a million more people in this city over the next 25 or so years. We also have managing Victoria's growth in provincial Victoria. And for those who haven't been out and about lately, I'd suggest people actually take the train to either Traralgon, Ballarat, Bendigo or Geelong. We have a fast rail service, an efficient service now linking our major regional centres with Melbourne and through Melbourne with each other. And we have seen extraordinary growth in regional Victoria. Places like Ballarat and Bendigo are strong, thriving, growing regional cities, and that's a vibrancy of their own economies in a policy framework where the state government has put in targeted investment into infrastructure in particular. We have the issue of dealing with an ageing population. I think the figure I saw recently that ageing will, and this is a figure from the Productivity Commission, that dealing with an ageing population will contribute around $40 billion per year to health expenditure across Australia in the future. It's an extraordinary and chilling figure. We do need to deal with an ageing population, and it's worth reflecting when I entered the workforce, there were 6.5 people in a workforce for every person who was a retiree. When I leave the workforce, and in politics sometimes not of your own choosing, but hopefully at a time of my choosing, when I would plan to leave the workforce, there would be 3.5 people in a workforce for every retiree. So the challenge of ageing leads very much into the next item of boosting productivity and participation, because without the improvements to productivity and workforce participation, we simply could not and cannot sustain the lifestyle that we've become accustomed to. But what we're seeing in all of these areas is change coming in Victoria and significant change that is contributing to some of the strength in this state. And just on, I'll come forward to some slides shortly on education participation and the like, but there is an extraordinary change. The unemployment rate is the lowest in many, many years, and a participation rate is now at an extraordinary high level. But I guess we've had a change of Premier a couple of months ago, and listing here are the seven priorities that John Brumby announced the weekend he became Premier. Now, these are overlays on the existing framework of this state government, and it's I won't go through all of them at any length, but it's interesting where the Premier's priorities are. education skills, lifetime learning we start off with. And again, it is such a key part to our triple bottom line. In an economic sense, the longer a person remains in school, the longer they will remain in the workforce. The correlation is extremely strong. In a skills sense, as a further subset of that, clearly the more we train, the more skills we have in place, the more equipped we are to deal with the economic challenges that we face in the 21st century. Moving through to public transport, which I touched on before in the economic sense, we have seen extraordinary growth in patronage in Melbourne on public transport, extraordinary growth. The Premier has announced two areas, one being trialling some of the more innovative ways to take pressure off, i.e. making public transport free early in the morning to take away from that morning peak, see how that works. If it works, we will roll it out further from our pilot. And secondly, bringing forward the rolling stock that we need to actually move more people on our public transport at peak times. So they are clear issues, and there's more to it than just those, but that's a priority of the Premier. There is certainly that urban development and planning, particularly in the outer suburbs. The Premier has announced a rejigging of the state bureaucracy so that the planning and essentially the community development functions are now in a one portfolio so that that can be streamlined and assist with the planning. We're very conscious we need to speed up a lot of these processes for economic growth, and we need to keep the balance right in doing so. It's a priority of the Premier. And similarly, the strengthening delivery of major projects. We have an extraordinary investment in infrastructure in this state. The delivery of major projects has always been a challenge and one that we are very determined to improve on, and we have, but there's still more to be done in that area. And finally, services to farmers, as I mentioned, and our regional communities, they are areas which, as I said, even now the Premier is dealing with some of the short-term issues there, but there are longer-term ones as well. To make Victoria a good place to do business, government will look at areas to make us more tax competitive for businesses to come into this state. And again, in the context where of our GST revenue, we maintain 88 cents in the dollar comes back to this state, and that means essentially we get $1.2 billion less than we would get if the Commonwealth gave it back per capita. Similarly, with our special purpose payments from the Commonwealth, we're a further $600 million out. So my starting point here is the line right across is the one, the zero line, is where Victoria is, and here we measure some of the other jurisdictions on a tax basis against Victoria. So starting with a $1.2 million deficit, which particularly in Western Australia and Queensland assists them in reducing state taxes, we've seen over a period of time where our state taxes our state taxes are lower than they are in New South Wales, and Queensland and Western Australia and the national average taxes are starting to come towards Victoria's. So it's one measure of how you have tax competitiveness. It's a complicated one. I think that's it's not one of my choosing. It's an ABS one, but to show in that sense where we're moving. It's also worth noting that we have cut payroll tax and land tax. We have also cut stamp duty and motor vehicle duty, and we abolished the taxes on the intergovernmental agreement for the GST faster than any other state. And then additionally, we have reduced our work cover premiums 4 years in a row, 10% per year. So we're conscious on removing business taxes that are going to slow down investment, but we need to do it in a framework where when you are penalised by $1.8 billion a year because you are the state of Victoria, then it is a harder proposition than it would be in Queensland or Western Australia. Again, I mentioned payroll tax. We have now come down to the second lowest payroll tax rate in the country. When we got into government, it was 5.75. It's now 5.05 and will become 5% on the 1st of July. Regulatory burden is one of those areas that is not something that gets a lot of people particularly excited, but the regulatory burden is something which actually slows down the capacity of business to invest. The Premier announced a bit over a year and a half ago, a target of Victoria reducing the regulatory burden by 15% over 3 years and by 25% over five. And one of my roles as incoming Treasurer was a very clear message from the outgoing Treasurer that he expected it to be delivered, and that we also need to publicly report on our targets of how it is going. And I released the first annual report of this at a VECI forum some weeks ago. And I guess what we see is that the commitment of that is that we reduce those over the 3 to 5 years. And if we go through, there are three things essentially there. One is we need to look at our regulation and cut what is unnecessary. Two, when new regulation comes in, we need to offset it with existing regulation in that part of government, and we need to proactively target hotspots to actually reduce it. And we've seen from the first year, we have a measure we've adopted from the European Union, which actually you can measure this, and we've seen about $29 million in reductions in the first year. As you see from the next slide, we will need to get up to $154 million of reductions by the third year if we are to meet the target that the Premier has set for the government and myself. And this is a challenge for us, but it's one that we will pursue and pursue with vigour and rigour, because it is one that, as we see from the bottom of that slide, if it takes 0.44% takes 0.44% of costs out of GSP in Victoria, that's $750 million a year, and that is a significant and further boost to our economy to do so. And I guess I would reflect that roughly these costs, for every dollar in a state jurisdiction, is about $1.50 in a federal jurisdiction. So again, if this is something that is copied by the Commonwealth, we can actually improve GSP, or GDP in that case, GDP by about 1%. And some areas already, so state some of the obvious ones that are, some of them are not particularly difficult. Sometimes the regulatory burden can be an area where unnecessary regulation or duplicated regulation that has, where the policy purpose is not affected, can be changed by simply looking at it and removing it or addressing it. Sometimes it can be things like by harmonising between state jurisdictions. If you have the same, some of the work cover admin backup, for example, between New South Wales and Victoria for the same policy intent, and by similar regulation, you reduce the burden. There are numerous examples of it, and it's a very interesting report I'd suggest anybody to read who wants to follow it further. Moving through on infrastructure expenditure, I touched on it earlier on. We have significantly increased our infrastructure spend in this state. When we got into government in 1999, the state spent about $900 million a year on infrastructure. In our last budget, as you see there, it got to just under 3.5, and in our forward estimates, we're planning for it to go a lot higher. The reason for the infrastructure spend is because the message is loud and clear. On a triple bottom line, we need to improve and address infrastructure if we are to go forward. On the economic sense, if we remove bottlenecks, if we actually put in place items that will actually assist, we make a difference. The Western Ring Road, when it was built some years ago now, for example, improved land values in the order of 10%, reduced traffic congestion, and saw a whole reshifting of where a lot of Melbourne's distribution outlets were because of that one road alone. We're seeing infrastructure makes an extraordinary difference, and we're committed to investing in it. And that is the ongoing path of that is quite strong. What we see in our infrastructure investment, there's a couple of areas where it comes under. In transport, we have a clear pipeline now, meeting our transport challenges announced last year by the Premier, $10.5 billion over 10 years towards road and rail infrastructure. In addition to that, in transport, in addition, there will be the issue of the Port of Melbourne with channel deepening, obviously subject to the special EES. There are things like the Geelong Bypass and many other projects above and beyond that. Our water, our future. A large program announced in a number of stages, but most recently the desalination plant, the interconnector, the issue of water piping to Hamilton, to Geelong, the whole food bowl, the Wimmera-Mallee pipeline, and essentially a grid across the state where water can be moved from one part of the state to the other. And again, with the desalination plant, effectively the equivalent of a third of Melbourne's annual water use, new water. Desalinated water that wasn't there before, and probably the first climate change proof water we have had. When you go through schools, a modernisation and regeneration program, $1.9 billion over 4 years, which involves 500 schools rebuilt or modernised, 131 in last year's budget, and when you consider there's 1,594 government schools, that's a big commitment in this term, and the commitment is that over 10 years, every school in this state will have been rebuilt or modernised. Why? Not because we like seeing nice buildings, that's a spin-off. It's because in a modern environment with good infrastructure, good ICT, you get better learning outcomes. A lot of our schools were classrooms designed for 30 people in an old building in front of a blackboard designed in the 60s. Modern teaching requires far more flexibility, and so this is an investment in our future generation. Health and community services, again, Royal Children's Hospital is just one big one at the moment. More housing units, and in the cultural area, whether it be the convention centre bringing in tourism, whether it be the rectangular stadium, whether it be some of the arts facilities, all of them adding to GDP for the state, and in many cases also adding to the social development of the state as well. Moving on to, well, how do we deliver them? We have been leaders in public-private partnerships in this state. We led. We're the first in Australia on many of these things, and we are now a leader in Australia, and our model and guidelines are being followed by other states, and actually in a project even by the World Bank. We have 16 contracted partnerships in Victoria at the moment at $4.5 billion. And a reason for these is if at the procurement stage a public-private partnership adds better value for money to the taxpayers of Victoria, it will be adopted. We have a public sector comparator to run it against, and we will continue to operate them when they add value for money, and often part of that value for money and an extra side off a side spin is the innovation that the private sector will bring with a PPP. And the desalination plant is the most recent one announced as one of those. Premier also announced a few weeks ago that he was asking myself and Bronwyn Pike, the Education Minister, to come back with proposals for PPPs in education. Now, this is all about leveraging further the $1.9 billion investment in this term to see whether we can get better value still, and by better value, even better facilities, and whether we can actually, with private sector participation and innovation, broaden the scope of what schools are used for in some instances to bring in greater use of the community facilities. So it's something that we are investigating, and from where we've been in government to date, if it adds better value for money, brings in more innovation, we will be very, very interested in it. I touched on earlier, we are seeing dividends for this investment. The graph you see shows, firstly, that Victoria has the highest retention in our education system in the country. So we set ourselves a target of 90% in a few years' time, and what we're seeing is a result of these policies, more Victorian students are either staying in school or a Year 12 equivalent than any other state or ever before. And a rationale for this, again, is not that we want to see students sitting in schools, that's a byproduct perhaps. The rationale is they become more equipped for the modern economy, more equipped to stay in the workforce and deal with that ageing syndrome I talked about before, and it is a good economic and social dividend for the state. We also see we have the highest level in the last 12 months of completions of apprenticeships and traineeships, and this is all about investing in people, and by investing in people we invest in our community, and it's worth noting that the OECD has said that investing in human capital, quote, is a fundamental building block for prosperity, end of quote. And that's why these areas will continue to be given such a high priority by John Brumby and his government, because they are such a critical part, human capital, for the future, and why, with our national reform agenda initiatives of this government, which we've prosecuted federally, the two first areas are literacy and numeracy and the skills you get in schools, and the next one is that issue of obesity and diabetes, so we can actually get the human capital that comes out of this is very strong. Climate change is an area I'll be very brief on because I'm conscious of the time. Essentially, climate change is a huge international area. This state, through the National Emissions Trading Scheme, this state is absolutely delighted that both sides of federal politics now support such a scheme. So our Victorian renewable energy targets are in place. We have a whole range of other things, and the one I will focus on in particular is the Energy Technology Innovation Strategy, or ETIS, which is a funding on our part in Victoria of $106 million over the best clean coal technology. One of our great economic assets is our brown coal reserves in the Latrobe Valley. In a time of climate change and carbon constraints, the issue of how we utilise clean coal is such a critical issue for this state's economy, as well as, with the triple bottom line, on the issue of climate change. So that's a huge state investment, and not only should it help us clean up our coal, it's also obviously a high technology export earner for us when that progresses. Concluding on where the Commonwealth is in grants, it reaffirms what I said before. The graph we see here shows from the 70s through to the 90s the revenue in the grey that states raise themselves from their own taxes. Then we show next to it the revenue that the Commonwealth gives to states as a percentage of GDP, and then the revenue the Commonwealth has in its own right. And what we see there is, if you say compare the money that the Commonwealth passes to the states, if you look at the 1980s amount there, average of 6.7%, and compare it to the 2000s average of 5.1%, we actually see that as a percentage of GDP, what the Commonwealth returns to states has actually diminished. And whereas we see what the Commonwealth themselves has done has significantly increased. This is important because the critical service delivery areas in this federation reside with the states, particularly the areas of health, education and public transport, and the Commonwealth is actually shirking on delivering revenue to the states. And that's the critical part if we have the service delivery. Another way of putting it is looking at GST revenue. Now, there are three bars on this graph, or three lines. When the GST was introduced, there was an acknowledgement that revenue would decline for the states in the short term because of taxes they were removing. So the bottom line is what was anticipated the revenue from GST would be. The next line, the dotted line, is the one that shows, well, this is how it will be adjusted by the Commonwealth, the anticipated growth, and we'll adjust it so that no state is disadvantaged. And you see that, that we aren't now, that the revenue is higher than it was anticipated it would be when the GST came in. So that is actually a bonus. But then we look at the third line. It actually shows you what would have happened if we had not abolished the state taxes for the GST. So this is financial institutions duty, bank accounts, debit tax, transactions on shares, all those particular taxes. And we actually see that the state of Victoria would actually have more revenue if the GST had not have been brought in. Now, I'm not arguing that the GST should not have been brought in, and a lot of those state taxes that were abolished were incredibly inefficient. But it is just a comment that the states are actually not better off under the GST. We actually have lost revenue. Now, moving on to back to my earlier point of Victoria and New South Wales, as you see from this graph here, Victoria and New South Wales actually are net losers of revenue through the GST and the special purpose payments. And the net beneficiaries, and no one has a particular grievance with states like the Northern Territory and some of the other ones having it, but we've traditionally had quite an issue with Queensland and Western Australia as resource states getting it. And the one thing I guess I would comment, since the last federal budget, the Prime Minister's come up with a term called aspirational nationalism, which is his reason for funnelling money from the state to the states since the budget. And what aspirational nationalism means, it's amazing how much of this nationalism seems to fall in these 16 designated geographical areas that happen to be federal marginal seats, and tragically none of them are in the state of Victoria. But my main point here is there is extraordinary scope for levelling the playing field on how Commonwealth grants move, and in doing so, the opportunities in Victoria to leverage growth of our economy, improve service delivery, are clearly there. So in conclusion, where we're really at is that our objectives in Victoria as a government remain quite clear. We want to ensure we maintain a strong financial position, a AAA credit rating, which the annual financial report so clearly showed 2 weeks ago. We want to deliver a budget operating surplus of at least $100 million, which again was reflected in the annual financial report. We want to keep our tax system efficient, fair, competitive with other states, so we can cement our place as a great place to live, work and raise a family. And we want to invest in world-class infrastructure for the whole state. So there's sort of the objectives of the Victorian government. The economic objectives remain. There is a new emphasis with the Premier's seven particular directions. But the biggest challenge for us continues to be and remains to be, with the levers at the place of the state government, how we can most effectively use them for keeping a budget in surplus, but particularly for targeted service delivery and targeted infrastructure services Getting the targeting right is our challenge. What makes the biggest difference for the state? That's something we'll continue to work and discuss with. But they're our challenges, and by doing so, we can make a difference, and we continue to have an economy that grows, and a growing economy ultimately means more livability, greater quality of life, and all the things that we're so proud of Victoria being. Thank you.